This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, Forrest Hilton, professor of politics at the Universidad Nacional de Colombia, Medellin, joins us from Salvador, Bahia, where he is a visiting professor, to bring us a comprehensive look at the historic June 19th presidential election in Colombia. Historic because for the first time, a progressive government was elected with Gustavo Petro, the former mayor of Bogota, and his vice president, the Afro-Colombian environmental activist and human rights lawyer, Francia Marquez, on a platform promising a green transition, tackling climate change while creating new jobs with labor rights and more. Their election spells the end of the far-right militarist politics that has dominated Colombia and promises new relationships in the region and the hemisphere, including the United States. We'll get Forrest Hilton's assessment of Petro's victory, the challenges ahead, and what we can look forward to when our program returns in just a moment. This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman, and today we are very fortunate to have Forrest Hilton with us, a Latin Americanist. He's going to fill us in on a bright spot in the world, which is a bit of relief for those of us reeling from the defeats inflicted by the anti-democratic Supreme Court in the United States. We'll do more on that later on another time, but today we're going to look at a bright spot, and that bright spot is Colombia, where the June 19th second round of the presidential election ended with a victory for the first leftist candidate ever in Colombia's history. Former Bogota mayor Gustavo Petro and his environmental activist and human rights lawyer vice president Francia Marquez won on a promise to make Colombia a leader in the global fight against climate change, despite a heavy challenge from the right. As Forrest explains in his London Review of Books article called Fiesta Democrática, this election is not just a new beginning for Colombia and Latin America. It spells a big defeat for Uribismo, the far-right militarist politics that has dominated Colombia for much of the century. Named for the right-wing Álvaro Uribe, who is currently on trial for bribery and witness tampering. We're going to get Forrest Hilton's analysis of the victory, the challenges ahead, and what it means for the hemisphere. So welcome, Forrest. I want to just introduce you properly. Forrest Hilton is an ethnohistorian of Latin America and the Caribbean. He's a visiting professor of history in the graduate school at the Universidad Federal de Bahia in Brazil, and an associate professor of political science at the Universidad Nacional de Colombia, sede Medellin. His books include The Evil Hour in Colombia, which is translated into Spanish, French, and Portuguese. And with Sinclair Thompson, he's the co-author of Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics. And I'm sure there's many more that we're not mentioning, but Forrest, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Susie.
I'm very happy to have you. So let's begin just with this historic election. On June 19th, former Bogota mayor Gustavo Petro and his vice president, Afro-Colombian environmental activist, human rights lawyer, Francia Marquez, made history by winning more than 50% of the total votes in Colombia's presidential election and will now form the country's first ever left-wing progressive government. We'll certainly get your take on the character of their politics and their leftism, but let's first get the overview. Gustavo Petro and his vice president, Francia Marquez, were elected with a strong climate agenda in the world's second most biodiverse country. Can you describe the challenges they overcame to win and what makes their victory in this election so historic?
So the first challenge was to their personal security and to their very lives. And they adopted innovative and hopefully signs of new security strategies to come that incorporated people who had been in frontline demonstrations in mid-2021 in Cali particularly, but in other parts of the country as well, people who battled riot police, but who during this campaign were trying to help out with logistics concerning security and work with Petro's security team. And also, particularly again in the Southwest, the indigenous guard, the Guardia Indígena from Cauca, was also incorporated into security for the campaign events. So the degree of security was pretty remarkable. And also the way that they tried to incorporate existing sort of civil society security strategies and logistics into their approach to preserving their own lives in order to be able to win the election. So that in itself tells you something about what Colombian politics is like and some of the things that have been going on in Colombian politics, as well as the importance, I think, of the Southwest, which would be Valle del Cauca with Cali as the capital, and then Cauca to its south, and then Nariño to the south of Cauca, bordering on Ecuador. So just that description of what it meant to run for president for these two helps you understand some of it. And the fact that there was a 150-year bipartisan political monopoly that came into being more or less around 1848 and lasted until 2002. And no kind of organized left, whether it was anarchist or socialist or communist or national revolutionary, could break into formal politics and get formal political representation or alter the country's constitutional order or its economic direction. They were kind of shut out. And there were efforts, especially in the 20s and 30s, to kind of shake up the system and to achieve certain kinds of, let's say, social democratic or left liberal reforms for the newly formed working class in cities that were beginning to grow rapidly, and issues of property rights for smallholding peasants in the countryside were being fought over in those years. So kind of important popular movements came into being. The Communist Party was there for the first time as a kind of element of opposition. And then the kind of left wing of the Liberal Party around the historic leadership of Jorge Eliezer Gaitán was also sort of involved in popular politics. But in the end, all of this kind of agitation was reabsorbed within the Liberal Party. And then the left liberal, Gaitán, was assassinated in 1948. So even within the Liberal Party, radical popular politics based in trade unions or peasant leagues, student movements, this was all prescribed. And then with the Cold War and the demonization of communism, kind of radical efforts based on the idea of armed struggle were demonized, criminalized, and persecuted with the help of the United States for a really long time. And in fact, Gustavo Petro himself got his political start in one of these guerrilla movements, a radical nationalist guerrilla movement that was based more in cities than the Marxist guerrilla groups that were based more in the countryside and oriented either towards basically Mao or kind of Stalinist international line. And then the radical nationalists, who were more urban and more middle class, and that was the group to which Petro belonged, they really began the process of demobilizing in the second half of the 1980s. They formalized their demobilization in 1990 so that they could help participate in the Constitutional Assembly, actually the Constituent Assembly, that redrew Colombia's constitution and drafted this new constitution. The 1991 constitution was hailed at the time as a really progressive document because it enshrines indigenous rights concerning collective use of territory. It enshrines public education and public health as rights. But all of this was a dead letter because Colombia's neoliberal economic model was only deepened. The kind of war between armed struggle, sort of guerrilla politics in the countryside, and counterinsurgency backed by the United States only escalated. And so the progressive side of that constitution has remained a dead letter, but Gustavo Petro has been pledging that if elected president, he's going to make that constitution a reality for the first time. And all those reforms that were never implemented in the 20th century and that led to persistent armed insurgency and then a kind of overgrown counterinsurgency, you know, he says that implementing these reforms would go a long way towards moving past this history of armed conflict. So he says peace and green energy transitions are sort of at the heart of his program and has his sort of new orientation for the country.
This is really good background, and I'm glad you gave it because it makes it sound as if, you know, it's been an incredibly repressive country. And we know that. And so it makes this breakthrough even more important, but also the challenges ahead. So, Forrest, you mentioned that his new presidency involves a challenge or a commitment to peace. And I take it that you mean a social peace, one in which the kinds of challenges that they had to overcome in the election were security, you know, was a primary concern. Quite incredible. So maybe you could go into that a little bit more about what it means to be invested in peace and who supports that, who opposes it. Could you just clarify that commitment to peace?
Sure. So Colombia had the longest running armed conflict involving guerrilla insurgencies based in the countryside. And then, as I mentioned, this overgrown counterinsurgency connected to the state, but not confined to the state, because a lot of the dirty work was essentially subcontracted out to paramilitary militias, which then became these kind of forces in their own right in politics and in land ownership and so forth. So peace and investment in peace is sort of an open question, because after the accords between the government of Juan Manuel Santos and the FARC guerrillas, Colombia's main guerrilla group, after those accords were signed in 2016, there were provisions for at least some degree of investment in productive enterprises and job creation in at least some areas of the countryside. And in 2018, a far right-wing government inspired by and controlled in large measure by Álvaro Uribe won the elections against Gustavo Petro and declared that they would tear the peace accords into scraps of paper. And so none of the investment that was supposed to materialize in the regions where the FARC had been active materialized. Hundreds of FARC activists, former militants, and mostly mid-level commanders who wanted to go into official politics, they were murdered. And that's exactly what happened, actually, to Gustavo Petro's compañeros when they tried to go into politics. He survived as a congressperson, but a lot of his comrades who were equally committed to like a constitutional electoral challenge to Colombia's oligarchy, a lot of them were murdered in the early 90s. So after the FARC demobilized, the investment never materialized, and these people who had acted on good faith and honored the accord signed at the end of 2016 with the Colombian government of Juan Manuel Santos, they were not only not allowed to do politics, they were murdered. So that left sort of remnants of the FARC guerrillas still active. And without the command and control structure that existed for a long time, pretty centralized, and fairly reliable mechanisms of transmission of information and carrying out of orders. It was a pretty functional bureaucratic machinery, a war machinery. And after the accords, it is no longer that. But you have regional remnants that call themselves either some name associated with the FARC or, you know, that's essentially just a recreation of one of the FARC fronts that existed before. So those are out there in a kind of patchwork that does not add up to anything nationally and is certainly no challenge to the Colombian army, which was really beefed up and reinforced by U.S. counterinsurgent support in the form of helicopters, communications technology, training for elite anti-guerrilla units, and so forth. So
what about, I was just going to ask you, because if we have time, we'll do a little bit about the U.S. support and Plan Colombia and all of that. But maybe you could describe for the listeners the balance of forces, because it's this was a victory. But how much of a victory was it? And how evenly divided is the country, if it is? And the opposition is all of the, let's say, opposition with these military militia forces or approach? Or is it something in between that's more right wing, but not in favor of continued war?
Civil war. A lot of business sectors were behind a peace process with the FARC. They supported this, both in Colombia and transnational businesses. They would like to be able to do business in the territories that the FARC long controlled. Many of those territories are rich in hydrocarbons. So there was also U.S. support for a peace process with the FARC, a militarily weakened FARC that was willing to negotiate peace more or less on the terms of the Colombian government. And so the United States was behind that peace process. But it's one thing to support a guerrilla group laying down its arms. It's another thing to actually commit resources to productive enterprise and employment for people who once had war as their full-time job. So I think that in terms of investment, there are business interests, constituencies of, you know, firms and economic sectors that recognize the need for some kind of investment and are not necessarily opposed to the idea. The question is who's going to commit the resources to make that happen. And that's where it seems that it would have to come from the central government. But the question maybe is creating a broad consensus among Petro's already spoken about this with the U.S. government, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and he linked those two things, investing in peace and transitioning towards green development. So there's lots of landlords, obviously, and people who are, let's say, cattle ranchers or people whose lands are given over to the cultivation of biofuels. And then there are probably cocaine trafficking interests who want to see the coca frontiers continually sort of expanded rather than brought under some kind of government control or regulation. So there's plenty of actors that would be opposed to, you know, significant investment in the countryside that would probably be oriented towards food production for the local and regional market. And in that sense, Colombia would probably cease to import so much of its basic foodstuffs from the United States and begin to produce some of what it needs. And of course, for a long time, Colombia produced most of its foodstuffs. So that wouldn't be a tricky thing to achieve. And it would be obviously a step in a greener direction. I think really the most controversial proposal from this new government, which as you mentioned, had a pretty narrow margin of victory, it's probably worth mentioning that Gustavo Petro made it to the second round of elections in 2018. He got 42% of the vote. That was more than double what any candidate from the left had ever gotten before. And his program and platform in 2018 was very similar to what it was in 2022. So he said Colombia cannot continue with rent-based extractive economy oriented around gold, hydrocarbons, coal, because it's not environmentally sustainable and it's not a path forward or a future for Colombia. So Colombia has to transition away from those things. And he says that he's going to do that by halting the signing of any further contracts for oil exploration, gas exploration, or kind of environmentally destructive natural resource extraction, but he's going to honor existing contracts. Mm. He's also said that in the effort to promote small-scale agricultural development, he's not going to expropriate any lands from large landholders and sort of confrontation with the degree of concentration of landed property in Colombia. He's not trying to confront large landed interests in promoting small-scale agriculture. So I think what he's really trying to do is find areas where he can build broad consensus without generating massive opposition. You know, I'm sure he has more ambitious schemes that would be tougher to sell. But I think the ones that I've named anyway give you some idea of what investment of peace might look like and how it's linked to a greener path of economic development, which would be less violent and more democratic.
And of course, that just takes us right away, Forrest Hilton, into the strongest part of their platform, Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez, which was for transition to a green economy. And also, I guess the major plank of that was to preserve the Amazon and stop the, you know, halt any further production that would erode the Amazon, recognizing how important it is, not just for Colombia, but for the world. So what are their proposals in that regard and how much support is there for it? I mean, is there a wide consensus in Colombia that climate is the key issue and that addressing climate like here would also be a kind of jobs program? That's the sort of idea of the Green New Deal in this country. And as you obviously know, there's a lot of opposition to that too. But how does it play in Colombia and what would it look like?
So it's interesting. The whole question of climate change politically seems to play out differently in Colombia. And the idea of a green economy, as Petro has said, sort of sets him apart from what came before in the Latin American Pink Tide governments, which, whether they wanted to or not, had little choice but to continue extracting, say, liquid natural gas in the case of Bolivia in order to get foreign reserves through gas exports. So, you know, moving away from an oil and gas-based economy and a mining economy towards something that's less destructive, that obviously is very ambitious in terms of where are the revenues going to come from that will be lost from contracts that could be signed for future exploration. But the contracts that are already signed for hydrocarbon and mineral exploration will obviously go on for, I'm not sure how many years, but some number of years, so that the government is going to continue to receive revenue. And I'm not sure if they're going to try to renegotiate sort of the environmental parameters of existing regimes of extraction, because really gold mining and oil and gas are really where much of the action is at economically, and obviously create enormous kind of environmental destruction in territories which are often either indigenous or Afro-Colombian, where communities are struggling for collective land rights. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of at stake in the future of these territories. And then there's also the question of coca production and the fact that hundreds of thousands of hectares, particularly in the lowlands, are given over to coca cultivation, and that selling coca paste is the main occupation of rural producers in those regions. So many of those regions are border regions, whether in the Amazon or the Orinoco along the Venezuelan border. And so cattle ranching and logging tend to go hand in hand with mining and or gas and petroleum extraction. And so you can see immediately how kind of the blocks sort of stack up against each other. What would be new is a central government that was really trying to adjudicate existing conflicts on these far-flung frontiers in favor of the majority of the citizenry and people without clout, because those are the people who got him elected. So what's interesting,
really complex.
It is very complex. And the ELN, the National Liberation Army, which never negotiated peace with the government, the FARC did and no longer exists, and the ELN did not, and it exists largely on the border with Venezuela and Colombia in kind of the north and northeast of the country. And the ELN guerrillas have already reached out to the Petro's people, saying that they're interested in discussing terms for a possible peace. Negotiations and relations between Colombia and Venezuela, astonishingly enough, were broken off altogether because Colombia went along with the farce of recognizing the so-called government of Juan Guaido. Until that just didn't exist anymore, even in the world make-believe, it became a thing of the past. But that's where Colombia stood, was very much on the side of the United States in relation to Venezuela. And for a very long time, right-wing Colombian politics ran on the accusation that Venezuela was secretly supporting the FARC guerrillas and that Chavez, the Chavez government, was a communist dictatorship and they supported the overthrow of the Colombian government. Again, that obviously was fantasy, but very powerful as ideology. And it's been used against Gustavo Petro several times. The first time he ran in 2010, then he ran in 2018. And every time it was said that, you know, he's a follower of Fidel Castro and he will turn Colombia into Venezuela if he's elected. But almost as soon as he was elected, the president of Venezuela reached out to him. So with the ELN and Venezuela, he can really knock out two birds with one stone, because it's by cooperating with the Venezuelan government that he can negotiate a lasting peace accord potentially with the ELN. And it's certainly in the ELN's interest to try to seize the moment and negotiate a peace deal.
Just one question on that, just because, you know, you mentioned this whole relationship with Venezuela and the supporting of the self-proclaimed, you know, government of Juan Guaido. But at the same time, because of everything that's happened in Venezuela, there's been an influx of migrants from Venezuela into Colombia. And just the question is whether how much that has played into, say, the electoral and national politics of Colombia.
For employers in Colombia, it's been sort of a goose that's laying golden eggs, because they get really cheap and very capable labor, and they're able to undercut Colombian wages very dramatically in any number of service industries, particularly in the cities. But millions of Colombians migrated to Venezuela in the 1970s during the oil boom. And so some of the people coming from Venezuela are actually descendants of Colombians several generations back. And there's a really important kind of historic connection there in terms of labor migration. But the fact of Venezuelan migrants streaming into Colombia, I think maybe has made it easier to fearmonger and say, you see these people streaming into our country right now. Well, you know, if you elect somebody from the left, you might have to flee Colombia in the same way. Right. And of course, there's a danger of capital flight. And I mean, probably a lot of Colombia's wealthiest already have their fortunes parked in offshore outlets in the Caribbean or even, let's say, Switzerland. But those Colombians who are invested in Colombia in some way are probably going to want to see what kind of terms they can negotiate with the new government, which is going to be more pragmatic than ideological. So there has to be an important sector of capital that is going to be looking to see what the new rules of the game are and what kind of terms they can get for themselves through the political process. Because as you mentioned, they don't have a parliamentary majority. They're the largest single force in Congress, both the Senate and the lower house. And that has never happened before. But Colombia's political system is really fragmented. So to get anything through Congress, they have to forge alliances. And they're hoping to forge an alliance with the Liberal Party, which is the second largest force and a historic force, but one that's much weakened compared to what it was when it dominated the system with conservatives. And then Petro's coalition has the support of the Green Party, and they got the support of Green Party voters in the second round of the elections. And I think even though it's a pretty small percentage of the vote, I think that was important for victory.
Let me ask you here. Many people are heralding the choice of the vice president, not only environmental activist and human rights lawyer, but an Afro-Colombian who grew up in poverty, Francia Marquez. And we began this question, I guess, this round about what the green economy would be. And you've laid out for us, Hilton, all of the, let's call them challenges that exist because of the large-scale coca production and the large-scale opposition to changing from hydrocarbons and mining and especially, you know, gold, oil, and gas revenues. So there's the difficulties on the one hand of actually putting into place this green transition. And on the other, you know, it really takes us into the next area I wanted to discuss, which is narcotics policy. And maybe you could sort of do them both and how it relates to almost everything that we've talked about so far in terms of security, growth, income, green economy, everything.
So one of the planks of the green economy that Petro and I assume Francia Marquez are betting on is tourism. And tourism in Colombia was non-existent for a period in the 1990s when its image was so closely connected with the kind of narco wars that were making headlines at the time. But it really picked up, I think, in the first decade of the 21st century and especially in the second decade. And they are hoping now to develop tourism to a much greater extent and turn Colombia into something more like Costa Rica in terms of sort of the constant flow of both dollars and euros into the Colombian economy. And certainly some of that tourism would take place in the vast and not very densely populated Pacific region, which is predominantly Afro-Colombian. And an ecologically kind of sustainable tourism of the sort, which does exist in Costa Rica, is certainly imaginable if it had support from the central government. And whatever criticisms, you know, one might have of tourist economies as they exist in the Caribbean and the types of racial hierarchies that are reproduced, I think above all, sort of imperial nationalist hierarchies are the most naturalized in these kinds of economies. But nevertheless, compared to palm oil plantations, which invade Afro-Colombian territories, or the banana industry, which is neither environmentally friendly nor worker friendly, although there are powerful banana unions in Colombia. But the idea is that tourism could really replace some of the more destructive elements of Colombia's economy, like cocaine exports. So the Pacific is another example where cocaine exports through Pacific territories are considered sort of strategic and crucial. And that's especially true in the Southwest, where Francia Marquez comes from. So one of the ideas is that by investing in both peace and green development, the attractiveness of growing coca on the frontier for the cocaine markets would diminish dramatically. So they're going to try to give incentives and subsidies to other forms of rural production, as opposed to letting the invisible hand of the market determine that coca is the only crop that you can sustainably grow and kind of feed a family with. So that passes through discussion, serious discussion with the United States about what would a different type of narcotics enforcement regime would look like. And Bolivia actually had experiences with this under Evo Morales. And before the DEA was expelled from Bolivia, I think in 2008, Bolivia had a lot of success in trying different approaches, less militarized approaches, manual coca eradication as opposed to chemical spraying in coca growers' territory. And I think Petro considers that that's one of the main things he has to discuss with the U.S. government, new strategies to approach narcotics control. But so much of the activity takes place on frontier territories that are peripheral, heavily either Afro-Colombian or indigenous, where there has never been any state investment before in any significant way. And the only forms of state that people are familiar with for the most part are sort of the military and the police and then kind of corrupt local officials and the notary public's office, which legalizes land transactions. And then the political parties, which jockey a lot at election time. As I said, it's a very fragmented environment. So people are familiar with a wide range of candidates from a wide range of parties selling the same snake oil. And so this seems to represent a possible departure towards something new in that regard. It's hard to say if the United States is open to serious discussion because Petro has said several things. He says he wants to develop capitalism and he wants to do so in an environmentally friendly way. Is that possible? We haven't seen examples of it, I don't think, but that's what he's aiming for. And he says pretty clearly that he basically wants to bring capital on board and bring at least some sectors of Colombia's oligarchy on board with the idea that, listen, this will be more sustainable. It'll be less violent. You know, we don't necessarily have to get into a confrontation with the United States. That's not in our interest. We're way too dependent on the United States to afford much in the way of direct confrontation. And we've seen what they do to Venezuela, right? And Petro also has a certain diplomacy towards the EU in this regard. You know, the EU talks a lot and then delivers so little. But, you know, it's like worse than the United States almost in terms of what it says and then what it does. But it's certainly conceivable that Spain and other countries in Europe would be quite interested in, let's say, developing a kind of green capitalism Colombia that they can profit off of. That's their interest. And Petro has no illusions that these firms want to make money. But the question is, what would then be the terms of debate or negotiation over how any of this investment would be channeled? Through what kinds of state institutions, right? What would be the kind of public-private partnership? That's what I see Petro striving for, because it doesn't seem the Colombia state would have the resources on its own to implement kind of this very ambitious kind of redevelopment scheme that also involves like free higher education, a canceling of student loan debt, reorient of the health system so that instead of being fully private on the U.S. model, it becomes a mixed model, more like Brazil, with a kind of robust public health sector, which is written into the 1991 Constitution. It's supposed to be a social right, but, you know, all these things have just been honored in the breach. So he has to sell the 1991 Constitution and the idea of the rule of law in a peaceful, democratic, and now environmentally just country. He has to see who he can sell it to in Europe, in the United States, and then, you know, within ruling sectors of Colombia, because he obviously has a large degree of popular support, particularly in the areas that are most directly affected by the kinds of conflicts that we've been talking about.
So let me just ask you, because you've done a really good job for us, Tilton, of tying it all together. And my last question to you was going to be about, you know, relations with the United States, since Colombia has been the cornerstone of Washington's policy for the area, security policy. But Petro, as you just stated, has promised to reassess the relationship and shift from collaboration on drugs and trade and Venezuela to working to stop the rapid erosion of the Amazon, tackling climate change. And as you say, too, you know, there's your description of the challenges, let's say, of shifting from the coca trade will involve more than just the United States. It's also, I guess this is another question to ask you to elaborate just a little bit on who opposes that. What about the people who are involved in the trade, the workers, as well as, you know, those who direct it, the narco, what do we call them? The, you know, the narco interests, let's say. So this all presupposes, I guess, new relationships within the country. And as you say, a commitment to actually making the Constitution passed in 1991 a reality. So maybe you could just kind of tie that together and talk about these giant challenges and how you see it going forward.
So when it comes to the persecution that narcotics leaders undergo at the hands of the DEA and elite units of the Colombian police, probably a lot of them would be willing to give something up or make some kind of concession in order to operate in a less militarized environment where they're less likely to be extradited to the United States and or murdered. So you can see where a new kind of approach, narcotics control, which is not calling for legalization of cocaine, its personal use of cocaine in Colombia is already decriminalized and has been since 1994. So that's not even an issue in Colombia. But the question of exports, obviously, is related to the international drug control regime that was established in the early 1960s. And so, you know, to get into the territory of legalization or even decriminalization of narcotics exports, that's beyond what an individual state like Colombia can aspire to. And I don't hear Petro sounding those notes about how to deal with the cocaine export economy. But in the same way that he would try to build consensus for protecting small-scale agriculture and promoting it, he would presumably try to build consensus for a less militarized approach to policing And, you know, certainly in Mexico, López Obrador has dramatically turned down the temperature from what it was under his predecessor in terms of where the drug wars in Mexico are today. So I think it's especially viable for the central government to try to sell a new economic model to people who live and grow coca in these areas. It's pretty obvious to many observers that given an alternative, most people who grow coca for a living would prefer to grow anything else and be involved in the production of any other type of agricultural commodity. But they produce coca because it is the only thing that pays a price that allows them to survive in areas where there is little in the way of social services or government investment. So if there was government investment that entailed an alternative livelihood, it's pretty easy to see a constituency forming around that. And it's sad to say, but truthful, I think. Poverty in Colombia is so dramatic that there would never be a shortage of workers in the narcotics industry. The reserve army of labor idea does not even begin to address the kind of structural unemployment that exists in Colombia, especially in the countryside. So there will always be enough workers in the industry, but it's really a question of kind of monoculture and cocaine and then other monocultures like palm plantations or banana plantations versus any other livelihood strategies and the extent to which the central government has never done anything to support small producers in their struggles to earn a livelihood. And that kind of goes back to the 20th century and the coffee export boom. So I think it's a lot in terms of what can be accomplished will depend on what kind of coalitions and kind of governing pacts they can forge on different issues or questions. But they have, I think, already been putting together kind of interdisciplinary teams that are working on either separate issues or a set of issues and that have a long track record working on these things. So there is a lot of experience and knowledge that has come out of social movements and public universities, particularly supporting peace all these years when Uribe was successful in converting half the Colombian population to the idea that it was better to continue with the war than to try the path of peace. So the struggle for peace has been incredibly tenacious and difficult, in part because no investment has ever materialized. I think a couple other points that are important would be labor law and the passage of a labor law that undoes the kind of neoliberal undoing of Colombian labor law. So in the early 1990s, basically, most rights and protections for Colombian workers were destroyed, were stripped away. And so returning some measure of legal protection and rights to the majority of Colombian workers would be an important step, obviously, towards some kind of organization. And there's also the question of tax reform and getting Colombia's most important firms and economic sectors and wealthiest individuals to pay some small amount of taxes, and even a small amount from any of those capitalist players would go a long way towards financing the public programs and services that the government says are its kind of reason for being. And they also claim that by eliminating all kinds of official corruption, essentially every level of government, they can also free up funds for investment in social programs. And one thing that I believe that they can accomplish, we'll see, but I'm optimistic that they can stop the murders and massacres of social movement leaders, which take place mostly in the countryside. A huge proportion of them are indigenous. It's absolutely disproportionate to the number of indigenous people in Colombia's population, which if I'm not mistaken, is just above 4%. And then I believe the Afro-Colombian population is closer to either 1/4 or 1/3, depending on how it's measured. But I think tax reform would certainly be an important step towards any kind of redistribution, because you mentioned Francia Márquez. And so she is the first Black woman vice president. But more important than whether she, you know, she's the opposite of Condoleezza Rice, certainly, you know, so it's not really about representation. It's about redistribution of state resources and then protection of communal ways of both exercising land tenure, but also of organizing urban neighborhoods and really trying to kind of give voice to those groups which have not had any kind of voice in official politics. And many of those groups even felt that while Gustavo Petro was a sympathetic figure, he was very distant from their kind of grassroots reality. Whereas Francia Márquez comes out of and has been a part of grassroots movements in the southwest of Colombia, where those movements are strongest. And she was the person who could articulate the grievances and demands of young people who were manning the barricades in Cali in the middle of 2021, when really nobody else in the Colombian kind of political sphere really was able to establish much dialogue with this grassroots uprising that took place in 2021. So she, I think, is really important in any number of ways, really, but especially in terms of keeping the door open to dialogue between the government and the various social movements that helped get it elected, but also keeping the defense of environmental questions in the face of logging, mining, coca production, and of course, oil and gas extraction.
We're really out of time, but I wanted to ask just one final, I guess, small question for us. And that is, you know, what impact will it have that now Gustavo Petro, let's say, joins Boric in Chile and Castillo in Peru and in Honduras, so that there is a new kind of, I'm not going to call it a pink tide because it's to the left of that. But there are other governments now that have elected green left-wing political leaders who are committed to climate change and social justice. Will this cooperation, do you think, yield any investment or any cooperation that might, you know, help Colombia on this to fulfill this program?
That's a really interesting question, right? Because when Chavez was alive, one of the things Chavez discussed was the difficulty of moving away from an economy based on petroleum extraction. And he named that as his kind of principal shortcoming, as something that he saw as a shortcoming and worked to overcome and was unable to overcome. And, you know, that is the situation of any Latin American leader elected with a sort of democratic popular majority with a mandate to redistribute wealth, introduce social justice and the rule of law, and so forth. So the climate now is obviously much more hostile economically than it was in the first cycle when left-wing progressive governments came to power in Latin America in the first decade of the 21st century. I don't think we can anticipate a kind of commodities boom of the sort that buffeted the redistributive efforts of those previous governments. I think it will hinge to some degree on whether Lula is indeed elected in Brazil or not, whether Petro's plans for greater regional integration, diplomatic, commercial, investment, cooperation on issues of international borders, flows of migrants, all of these things are viable. They don't require a lot in the way of resources. They require enough political will, which up until now has been missing because Colombia has been the single closest ally of the United States in South America, rather than a kind of partner in these previous efforts to build a regional sphere of cooperation through different international organizations. So I think this time around, we certainly can expect Petro to work with Maduro and the government of Bolivia and the government of Chile and the government of Argentina towards rebuilding these mechanisms of international cooperation on different fronts. And to the extent that they were able to do that, it would open up new sources of investment, potentially, but it would also open up new avenues for essentially negotiating U.S. policy towards the region. Because if there's some degree of unity, then the United States is not going to be able to divide and rule. So I imagine that the longer term strategy of Petro as well as Lula is to bring everybody back together in order to see what might be possible, regardless of whether the United States likes it or doesn't like it.
We've run out of time, but I'm so glad that you answered that last question because it ends on a hopeful note. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Jacobin Radio, Forrest Hilton, and for bringing us this really comprehensive analysis of where Colombia is today after the successful election of Gustavo Petro and where they, you know, may go and the difficulties that they face. So thanks very much for joining us. Let me just say, Forrest Hilton is an ethnohistorian of Latin America and the Caribbean. He's a visiting professor in the graduate school at the Universidad Federal da Bahia in Brazil, but also an associate professor of political science at the Universidad Nacional de Colombia in Medellin. Thanks so much for joining us today, Forrest.
It was my pleasure, Susie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Susie Wiseman. This is Jacobin Radio. Thanks to producer and director Alan Minsky and to Jacobin Radio's Micah Utrecht. Bhaskar Sunkara is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine. And special thanks to Robert Brenner. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Susie Wiseman.